I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ginny and Carrie Dennehy are two parents who will soon set off for a cross-country cycle across Canada to raise money and awareness for mental health. They'll cycle some 8,000 kilometers from Whistler, British Columbia to Cape Spear, Newfoundland, beginning on Mother's Day, the 12th of May, 2013. Along the way, they'll talk about their son, Kelty, who died in 2001 at the age of 17, committing suicide, having struggled with depression. Mr. and Mrs. Dennehy lost their 23-year-old daughter, Riley, in 2009, who had struggled with the loss of her brother for years. Soon after, they started the Kelty Patrick Dennehy Foundation, and their goal is to raise awareness about teen suicide, which is the second leading cause of death for young people in Canada. It's an essential message, and Ginny Dennehy joins me now to talk about her children, the cycle across Canada, and the need for greater awareness with regards to mental health issues. 70% of mental health problems begin during childhood, and those that need help often find that access to services they need is lacking. There's also the stigma surrounding mental health issues, which we'll discuss, and I'll get Ginny to dispel. Visit thekeltyfoundation.org for more information. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Whistler today, Ginny Dennehy. Mrs. Dennehy, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
It's hard not to admire the work that you and Carrie do. And because of these remarkable losses that you've suffered, the grace with which you're helping so many others, when you have a moment alone, say, do you ever wonder to yourself, why us, why me?
Well, you know, yes, of course you go to that place at certain times, and you know, the anniversaries are always hard. Certain times of the year are always hard. But I believe that you need to focus on the positive. And it's not always easy, but you have to realize about all the things that you do have in life and all the positive things that you have in life. And it's taken a while to get there, you know, especially when you lose one child in your life, and you would never in the world think that you would lose another child. But I focus on the gifts that I've been given through my children.
Yeah.
And one of the things is to be able to give back.
And if in the work that you both do now, you can save at least one child, it's all worth it, isn't it?
Well, it's all worth it. And I remember in 2001, when we started the foundation, we had our first board meeting at my parents' place, which is in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And we said, we gathered around and we said, if we could save one child's life, or help one person through this to not travel the same journey that Carrie and I had traveled, and maybe raise $25,000, then this is what we need to do with starting this foundation. And we have raised to date almost over $5 million, and I think we've saved or helped a lot of people.
Yeah. Now, I've read what you and Carrie have written about Kelty's story, and people can find that on the website.
Right.
There are articles that have been written on Kelty and on you guys over the years that people can read there. How does a person who's depressed, who is suffering from mental illness, know that they're suffering? And in terms of Kelty's experience, he must have known.
Well, you know, you have to understand, this was in 2001, and the information about signs and symptoms of depression are not as available as they were then. But we did know that Kelty was suffering some type of depression when he was going to Notre Dame. We had him at the doctors in the schools, and you knew things like his lack of sleep, his lack of focus. Kelty was a person who loved life, and he did a lot of things, and had a million friends, and when he starts to kind of retreat back into wanting to be around people, then we know that there's something different with him. His whole eating habits had changed. So there's some physical things like that. But I think also as a parent, you know your child. You know when something is going on a little bit different. And the one thing that was that we were very lucky about with Kelty is Kelty was very close to us, and Kelty would tell us when things weren't right. He would tell us when he wasn't feeling right. And so that's an advantage I think I had as a parent, because of the relationship that I had with Kelty. And I think as a parent, you need to, pick up on any single signs or whatever that your child isn't kind of normal as it used to be, you know, ask them those questions. Kind of dig a little bit deeper. Don't be afraid to ask the tough questions. And that's a really key point.
It really is frightening to see how depression's escalated in our society. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I'm not sure if depression has escalated in our society, or I don't know if we are just now being more aware of it.
I see.
I certainly know that as a child, there seems to be more and more pressure put on kids and families and everything today. It's just whether you're getting into university or whether you're doing whatever. It just seems to be so much more out there. You know, the way that we communicate, all this instant communication, it's the pressure seems to be building. But I'm not sure if depression as the disease is any more prevalent today than it was before. Like depression, and I'm not a doctor, so please understand that. Mm-hmm. I'm not a doctor, but I do know more about depression now than I knew before. But, you know, there's physiological things that go on in the brain now, that go on in the brain that cause depression, and those are things that I don't think that they've really changed from now until, you know, from when we were, you know, before.
Mm-hmm. How did you get the name Kelty, by the way?
Well, Kelty was, like, we were, you know, heredity is Irish.
Uh-huh.
And it actually happened to be the last name of a very good friend of ours. But it was interesting when we went and we looked up the name Kelty, what it means.
Mm-hmm.
The name of Kelty actually means turbid waters, which is very interesting, thinking, you know, the struggles that actually Kelty went on during the last part of his life.
Yeah. As siblings, Kelty and Riley, they were pretty close, weren't they?
They were very close. I mean, you got to understand they were 2 years apart, and Kelty was this type of a child who, you know, he was really kind of in your face. He loved life, and he was always wanting to get that extra smooch from Riley, and Riley was a little bit more reserved and kind of said, oh, you know, come on, Kelty, leave me alone. But she just loved her brother. Her brother, she looked up to him because he was, he was her big brother, and she loved him.
And so the loss on the loss of Kelty was quite hard on Riley, was it?
The loss on Riley, the loss of Kelty on Riley was extremely hard. You see, one of the things about Riley, when she was a little child, she suffered from asthma, very, very bad asthma. She was in and out of Children's Hospital in ICU 8 times. She was on life support, and so we just about lost Riley a couple of times. So it was really hard when Kelty was little, and, you know, we'd in and out of the hospital the whole time because we were all focusing on Riley. And then what happened when Kelty died, Riley was so intense in her grief, she didn't know how to express anything. So one of the things that happens with people who are suffering in some way, they turn to something that they can control. And for Riley, what happened was an eating disorder. And she ended up with a very, very serious eating disorder where we couldn't get her help, so we had to take her down to the States, which was, you know, you can only imagine how hard that was for both Carrie and I, having gone through just losing our child and now seeing our other child suffering so much with this eating disorder. But Riley eventually got okay, and we got her healthy in that way, and she came back, but she was still lost. She was totally, totally lost about what to do, because she had not only lost her brother, she had lost her best friend.
Yeah.
So she struggled, but she, you know, graduated from high school. She graduated from Vancouver Film School, and she, came back up here to Whistler to live. But then what she really, really found to help her through everything is she found yoga. And yoga was the thing that kind of led her into her happiness.
And she went to school in Asia for that, didn't she?
Well, she took her first training here in Whistler, and then she wanted to take more courses. So she went to Thailand to take those courses. She had a vision of starting up a business here in Whistler. And so she completed the course, and she said, I could do the business things because, you know, having been with IBM for 28 years,
mm-hmm.
that I knew the business side of things, and that she was going to teach yoga, and she wanted to teach Thai massage.
I see, yeah. Well, when you think about what happened to Kelty, you must, as a parent, replay everything in your head, you know, what could have you done, and, you know, what you could have done better. It also can be quite self-destructive to do that. So how do you deal with, say, hindsight and the sort?
Well, that's a very good question, because you know anybody would go through that whole thing. Because I was away on a business trip when Chelsea took his life.
Yeah.
And you can only imagine the guilt that I went through. But Chelsea, it was interesting, and this is kind of another little kind of sign that I didn't know, obviously, at the time, but when Chelsea was having the struggles and he was at Notre Dame School, Carrie encouraged Chelsea to start a journal, so he wrote his journal. And so what happened was that when he came back, he said to me, and he knew I had this business trip, and Carrie was originally going to go on this business trip with me, and he says, "Mom, I want you to read my journal. So I read this journal, and I could see how he was suffering and how hard it was for him. And then at the end, he talked about how he would do anything for his mother. He was a bit dramatic. I'd take a bullet for my mother, or I'd do anything, but how much better he was getting and everything. And he came to me afterwards, and he said, "See, Mom, I'm getting better. I think it would be really good if you went on the trip and Dad could stay with me. Just Dad'll, you know," because he says, "Dad and I don't have enough time together. This would be really good." And I thought, well, you know, gee, maybe this is a good idea. But I now realize that Kelsey had that all planned, because he knew that I could never be here when he took his life.
Yeah.
So you go back into all those things to answer your questions, and you think, oh, my God, if I had only stayed home. Oh, my God, if I'd only done this or that. But I think the thing is that I realize now that if someone is so determined to take their life, that they will find a way no matter what. And the other thing that what gets me through this, the day, or how I deal with this, I could not have loved that child more.
Mm.
And I told Kelsey told me how much we were a very loving family, you know. I'd see him in the middle of Whistler Village, and he would be there with all his kids. You know, like, they were 17, right? And he'd come up, and he'd give me a big hug, and he says, "Oh, Mom, you're the best mom in the world." And all his friends would say, "Well, Kelsey, that's kind of weird to do to your mother."
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? Those are the things that keep me going, is the memories that I have of Kelsey. And that's what I think is really, really important. And that's what keeps me going and keeps me knowing that I have to do what I'm doing for Kelsey and for Riley. I owe it to these kids. I owe it to my children.
God, what wonderful lessons they're teaching you and Carrie and the rest of us, aren't they?
Well, it is, because, you know, I mean, I just wrote a book, and it's very, very funny that I just received the books about a half an hour ago.
They really?
Arrived on my doorstep. And, you know, my book is called Choosing Hope, A Mother's Story of Lost Love and Survival. And that's what it's all about, is because in this world, you do not have a lot of choice about what happens to you, but what you do have is you have a choice in how you deal with those things. So that is the really important thing. And because my relationship was so strong with my children, they're kind of like my guardian angels, kind of helping me kind of weave through the rest of my life.
Yeah. Hey, the relationship that husbands and wives and mothers and fathers have, I mean, that's obviously tested in times of crisis like this. How did you and Carrie, how did you manage that? How did you weather that?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, because the statistics are between 85 to 90% of people who lose a child do not make it together. And this child could be lost in any way. He could have had cancer or tragic accident or anything. I don't think there are any statistics about people who lose two children. And Carrie and I have become closer and closer and closer, you know, as the years have gone on. And whether it's just that we just need each other so much, and we depend upon each other, and we support each other. I mean, Carrie and I have been together, we've been married for 32 years, and we were together 10 years before that. And I just could not imagine traveling the journey that I have traveled without his support. It's just so important. And he cannot imagine traveling this journey without me. Like, you can't blame anyone for what has happened to our children. Riley's death was a complete accident in Thailand. She separated her shoulder a doctor gave her some medication. The medication caused a heart attack.
Yeah.
You can only imagine what a shock it was to me to find that out.
Yeah. There's an awful stigma around mental illness. I mean, it's quite harsh in the workplace, at home even. You know, I've talked to a lot of people over the years who've tried to combat that, people like Sheila Rogers and Rafe Mayer, Michael Schrader. There's still a lot to overcome, isn't there?
There is still a huge to overcome. I mean, I remember when we started working with the foundation, and this was over 10 years ago, and we were working with the VGH-UBC Foundation, and I remember the fellow there said, you know, where mental illness, depression is where cancer was 25, 30 years ago. It was that stigma. I don't know if you remember the big C. Oh, somebody's got the big C. That's kind of where we are with mental illness right now. We're getting there, but we are still miles and miles away from where we need to be. Because it's still this thing, oh, not in my family. What really upsets me so much is when I see parents who don't sit there and recognize the signs and symptoms of what's happening to their children and knowing that they have to go for it and get help. That's what really upsets me because, as you said earlier, is that a lot of these children, you know, suffer from mental illness in very early in their youth. And if they could, you know, be diagnosed and get on the right program and get the right help, maybe they wouldn't have to, you know, live their adolescence life or their adult life with a mental illness.
Have we got enough resources, say, I mean, you and I both live in British Columbia. Are there enough resources out there for people that need help and seek help?
No, there absolutely are not enough resources, and that is the real challenge. So we'll take an example of, let's say that you had cancer and that you found out you had cancer. Well, you're probably going to be able to get into the cancer clinic pretty soon, right, mm-hmm. like fairly quickly. If you are, let's say, diagnosed or you finally have the nerve to go to a doctor to find out what's going on, it's going to take you weeks, months, or whatever to get in to see somebody. We need to fund mental illness like we fund heart disease, like we fund cancer. We have to treat it like any other disease until we do that. I mean, the statistics are absolutely amazing about this is going to be the leading cause of workplace disability in 2020. And we're nowhere to be able to address that.
Yeah. Who's
never
that?
Mind children. Never mind children. And that's what upsets me even more is
exactly.
The children.
Yeah. Yeah. And along this journey that you'll take across the country, you'll be speaking, trying to speak to a lot of young people too, I'm assuming, right?
Yes. We're trying to definitely speak to the young people. We're trying to arrange rallies in the different towns and cities that we go across and speak to them. We're very involved with our sponsors. So we're going to have rallies for some of their employees and talk about that. Because when you start to talk about that, that is when people can start to kind of relate to it. When they start to hear Kelty's story, because Kelty was a normal child, right? He was a normal kid who lived a normal life. He played hockey. He went to school. He did all these things. And he just happened to get a disease, and the disease happens to be called depression, what happens to be a mental illness. There's nothing to be ashamed about that. Nothing.
Whose idea was it to cycle across the country?
Well, we had, for the last 2 years, we participated in the Grand Fondo that goes from Vancouver to Whistler.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so we've had kind of like little mini fundraisers in there. We called it the Ride for Life, and we raised $43,000 here and you know, $25,000 there for that. And then it was our executive assistant, Carol Becker, who said, well, you know, you guys did the Grand Fondo. Why don't you ride across Canada? And I thought, gee, that's an interesting thing. Why don't we ride across Canada? And I also kind of thought, well, I better ride across Canada now because I better check my birth certificate. I'm over 60. I better hurry up and do this now before I can.
Yeah.
So that was the reason why we've decided to do it.
And so it's you and Carrie, but there'll be other people as well?
Yes, there's Carrie and I who are going to be the main riders as we go across. But we've had amazing support from our friends and different group. Like I cycle with the TAG cycling group out of North Vancouver and Whistler. and they're going to get some people to cycle along with us, and there's different people in Toronto who are going to join us. So we're encouraging people to come along, because that's when you kind of gain that momentum.
Yeah. And you've got this trailer. I read on the Vancouver Sun blog that Carrie's doing, I guess.
Yes.
That you've got this trailer, so I guess you'll be cycling, and then that'll be going along with you. And then, I don't know, do you use that to sleep in at night? Or?
Yeah, we've been very, very fortunate that we've had a 33-foot RV who've been donated to our foundation by Rod and Jeannie Semp. And that is going to be our headquarters. It's going to be where we sleep, where we kind of, it's going to be kind of our protection vehicle, as well as we're going to be towing a car, a Hyundai car, which they have donated to us as our kind of support vehicle. And we have, as our crew, who is going to be our bike crew, is going to be our two nephews from Whitehorse, Quinn and Keenan Dennehy, who are going to be the driving the RV. They're going to be the cooks, the bike maintenance, the massage therapists, and the social media gurus.
Mm.
So they're going to be very, very busy.
And we can follow you on the website, thekeltyfoundation.org.
Yes, you're going to follow us there. You also can follow us along on our Facebook page and Twitter. Our handle is Enough is Enough. That is kind of our slogan for our ride.
I've just turned 31, and so in reading about Kelty, I found it interesting because I guess he'd be 30 now, right?
Yes.
Do you and Carrie, you and Carrie must obviously think about him all the time. Did you ever wonder what he might have, how he would have turned out had he lived?
Absolutely, absolutely, because I see his friends, and his friends are starting to get married now. His friends are, you know, they've got real, you know, real people's jobs, and I know Kelty would have been very successful at whatever he did, and he was a beautiful-looking boy. I'm sure he would have probably been married or engaged by now, and he would have gone to Bishop's University and would have graduated. Probably he would have followed me in business, and I know that he probably would have been a very successful young man. But the thing is, and you know, I've thought about this a long time, because I've talked to a lot of people who do suffer from depression, and people who are maybe in the 30-year-old range or 29, and they've suffered from depression maybe, you know, for X amount of years. But the thing that was different between them and the thing that's different between Kelty is Kelty was young. He didn't understand that this wave will pass, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the, you know, the advantage or whatever of people who have suffered from depression or still suffering it, understand it's a wave. And they'll go down into the bottom of the wave, but they will come up out of the wave, and they will continue on. And the wave might be getting a little bit smoother, but then, you know, you might have your rough times, but you're going to come up, and you're going to be okay. Kelty didn't have that experience. He was too young. He was too impulsive.
Yeah. Jeannie, to you and Carrie, all good wishes for the cycle across the country. God bless you, and best of luck.
Okay, thank you so much.
The website for more, thekeltyfoundation.org. Jeannie Dennehy joined me on the line from Whistler in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.